Good afternoon, and welcome to the inaugural State Affairs Committee hearing of 2021 in the 32nd Alaska Legislature. And I'm calling the meeting to order at 3:01 p.m. Tuesday, February 23, in the Max Grunberg Room in the Capitol. And let's see, I'm actually going to take a quick at ease. Able to take the roll.
Representative Eastman?
Here.
Representative Story?
Present.
Representative Vance?
Here.
Representative Tarr?
Here.
Representative Kotzen?
Here.
Chair Price Tompkins?
Here. And with six members present, we have a quorum. No excused absences today. And before we get to the two items on today's agenda, I just wanted to take the opportunity to touch on a couple of practices that I hope to sort of generally embody with running this committee over the next couple of years. And these are all sort of flexible and could be revised per the will of the committee, but generally speaking, always at least two hearings on any piece of legislation, even seemingly innocuous pieces of legislation. There have been exceptions to that in the past when there's considerations of time sensitivity, but just so people know, there's just the sort of two bites an apple routine. Another point that I wanted to speak to is usually we'll take up amendments on a piece of legislation at the second hearing, or if it's a very complex piece of legislation, a subsequent hearing thereafter. Public testimony, likewise, is usually taken up in the second hearing, or if it's a particularly complex piece of legislation, a hearing thereafter. And if necessary, there can be multiple tranches of public testimony. And lastly, I really aspire to run the committee in a way that we're choosing pieces of legislation for the committee's consideration that are substantive in terms of policy, that are more unifying than they are divisive, and without regard to geographic, caucus, party, or any other sort of affiliation. So I'm hoping actually the agenda on the first day of this committee is somewhat representative of that in my intent, but just sort of wanted to put that out on the record for everybody, and happy to take any of that up in private conversation or anything else, but just to sort of share some thoughts on direction of the committee. And I think just the last thing is the committee is kind of a Velcro committee in terms of its jurisdiction, the affairs of the state, if you will. And so it's a real treat. I've always enjoyed this committee because of the really diverse subject matter that we get to consider. So it should be fun these coming years. And the last administrative note I wanted to add is we're very lucky to have Grace Irvine staffing the committee this week, and then starting next week, an experienced legislative staffer by the name of Jeff Stepp, who some of you may know, will be aiding the committee effective next week. And so with that, I'd also like to thank Sophia in House Records, who's remotely recording this meeting, and a reminder to silence cell phones if you have a cell phone, and also a welcome to Representatives Rauscher and Johnson, who are in the audience right now. And that takes us to the agenda today. We have two pieces of legislation on today's agenda, House Bill 3, relating to the definition of disaster, relating to cybersecurity by Representative Johnson, and House Bill 32, sponsored by Representative Rauscher, relating to immunity for RV parks and campgrounds. It's the first hearing for both pieces of legislation. Per the two bites of the apple practice described earlier, intent is to hear and hold both bills. With that, barring any other thoughts from the committee, we'll invite Representative Johnson and her staff, Eric Cordero, to come up and present House Bill 3.
Good afternoon. And thank you, Mr. Chair, members of State Affairs Committee, for hearing this bill, HB 3, For the record, I am Representative Delana Johnson from House District 11. House Bill 3 is an act related to the definition of disaster. By now, I think all of us are familiar with an emergency declaration. When I first started and filed this bill, that was not the case, but there are many events that will elicit a declaration of an emergency, but cyber threats and security is not one of them. So right now, our statutes are vague about whether a cyber attack or a cyber threat could elicit such a declaration. This bill adds cybersecurity to the definition of disaster to update our laws, give clarity, and that in the event it's needed, action can be taken and resources can be used. There is an alarming rate of cyber threats throughout the world. Not long ago, just in my own community, the Matsu Borough was shut down after a cyber attack. It wasn't just a small cyber attack, it was a very long and disruptive cyber attack, and it created severe disruptions in day-to-day service operations in that local government. The city of Valdez was the target of a ransomware attack and spent quite a lot of money from their limited resources to regain access to their systems. Another example are states of Louisiana, Florida, and Colorado. A few years ago, they declared an emergency after a cyber attack disrupted most of their government operations. And let us not forget that several of our state agencies have been targeted by cyber criminals, including our Department of Health and Social Services and the Alaska Division of Elections. In summary, cybersecurity needs to be added to the list of reasons for an emergency declaration to have the ability to utilize emergency funds, apply for other funds and resources that may not otherwise be readily available, and for disaster preparedness planning. My staff, Eric Cordero, will go over the language of the bill, and we do have some invited testimony. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
For the record, my name is Eric Cordero, staff to Representative Delana Johnson. I hope you can hear me. As Representative Johnson mentioned, the bill adds cybersecurity to the definition of a disaster. Specifically, the bill adds a subsection F to AS 26-2900, which are the general provisions of the Alaska Disaster Act. So the subsection F that will be added reads, a cybersecurity attack that affects critical infrastructure in the state, an information system owned or operated by the state, information that is stored on, processed by, or transmitted on an information system owned or operated by the state, or a credible threat of an imminent cybersecurity attack or cybersecurity vulnerability that the Commissioner of Administration or Commissioner's designee certifies to the governor has a high probability of occurring in the near future. The certification must be based on specific information that critical infrastructure in the state, and this is an item that I will cover in a few minutes, an information system owned or operated by the state, or information that is stored on, processed by, or transmitted on an information system owned or operated by the state may be affected. The reason why I paused when I say critical infrastructure is because that was a question that I heard from some legislators and staff when I was going around asking if they had any questions about this. And two items came up during the conversations. One is most of the language of the bill addresses state-owned or state-operated systems. What about the nonprofit sector or the public sector in which, the private sector in which they have some sort of responsibility to the public, be it in health, energy, telecommunications, transportations. And so by saying that the certification must be based on specific information that critical infrastructure in the state, that means that it can cover all those areas. As for what's on the list of critical infrastructure, I had an opportunity to talk to folks from the Department of Military and Veteran Affairs. They are responsible for planning, managing, and putting together the list of what is critical infrastructure. I cannot get a copy of the list because I don't have the clearance for that, but we do have Paul Nelson with DMVA that might be able to answer some of their questions. critical infrastructure is not defined in our statutes, but DMVA uses the definition by the federal government, in this case, by the Department of Homeland Security through a division that deals with cybersecurity and other threats. I want to mention something else quickly. When I approached Ledge Legal on Representative Johnson's request to learn more about cybersecurity, I asked them if the governor could currently call an emergency if there was a cybersecurity attack or threat. And what Ledge Legal told me is that they could in some instances, but it's very vague, because in the year 2000, the legislature removed language from the Disaster Act that used to say man-made causes. In states where they have declared a statewide emergency on cybersecurity, they have man-made disasters, so man-made acts that can create a disaster. So in Alaska, we don't have that. There is a small provision in the statute that talks about equipment. So it could be argued that equipment could be considered information systems or a database or something, but this will clarify the language. It'll make sure that we are up to date, because as Representative Johnson mentioned, it is a problem that is happening quite often. According to the Department of Administration, just in the last 10 years or so, there have been so many attacks, attempted attacks, which are either generally nature like spam mail, viruses, malware, 817,000 per year. Directed attacks, which could refer to attacks that are focused against specific individuals or systems or departments, 400,000 a year. Now, this doesn't mean that the attacks were successful, but this means that the attacks were intended, that they were able to do something about it, or at least they knew about it. Now, successful attacks refers to attacks that were successful against the state. Systems or data were either infiltrated or compromised, 497 per year. And so, historically, most of the state agencies that get targeted are Division of Elections, Motor Vehicles, Revenue, Health and Social Services, and Transportation. One of our invited guests to testify is from the Department of Administration, the Chief Information Security Officer, and he'll be able to answer more questions in detail. And I don't know, Mr. Chairman, if you have any questions at this juncture.
No, thank you very much for the bill presentation. If it's the will of the committee, we could proceed with invited testimony from DOA and DMVA, and I believe the sponsor's office has also lined up testimony from a cybersecurity expert in the Matsu Peter House as well. So maybe we can proceed to those three individuals and then open it up at large for questions from the committee. Mr. Cordero, Representative Johnson, between Mr. Brunig, the Chief Information Officer, or Paul Nelson at DMVA, is one of those two preferred as first invited testifier?
Whatever you prefer, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Great. We'll go alphabetically. Mr. Brunig, can you hear us?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, State Affairs Committee members. This is Mark Brunig. I'm the Chief Information Security Officer for the State of Alaska in the Department of Administration. As mentioned recently, states such as Florida, Texas, Washington, and even the federal government have been impacted by cyber attacks. As Representative Johnson mentioned, in July of 2018, the Matsu Borough and the City of Valdez were both victims of cyber attacks, and in both instances, critical services were disrupted and significant damage was done. Ultimately, the emergency relief funding in the Matsu Borough alone exceeded $2.5 million, and the attack had far-reaching and lingering impacts even till today. I was one of the many volunteers who was on-site and provided support to restore service. And a big question we had at that time was, where was the state? Now, upon joining the state, I found out that it was not that the state was not sympathetic or did not wish to be supportive, but rather the language to address a major cyber attack was just missing from that definition list. as to what is included as a disaster. So this bill simply seeks to remedy that gap. A couple other examples, just to go over Florida. Just recently, attackers gained access to industrial control systems at a water treatment plant in Florida, and they tried to increase the amount of sodium hydroxide in the water to dangerous levels. You guys can easily imagine multiple different types of attacks, election systems that were mentioned. So putting this language back in is critical to the success and the support processes for disaster remediation in the state. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Brunig. And we could actually maybe pause. And are there any questions from the committee for Mr. Brunig? Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And through the chair, I'm curious, in the situation you were just referencing, how far into the disaster declaration process did the Matsu Borough make it? I know you mentioned that this lack of definition was an obstacle. How far into that process were they able to go without the definition?
Thank you for that question, Representative, through the chair. So after coming on board and doing some digging, I found that emails were received from the Matsu Borough, and the question was raised, and MBA said, well, we do not have anything legally. We don't have anything on the books to respond, and so we are unable to respond at this time. So the request was received, but they weren't able to actually do anything at that time.
Thank you.
Representative Klayman.
Thank you. A couple of questions. It always strikes me that when it comes to cybersecurity, not the things that might result in, say, a discharge of pollutants because somebody's affected a waste management system by damaging the software, but just these cyber attacks where folks get access to critical information, it seems like we're under threat of that almost every day, and we only know about them when it's happened. What's the real potential that we're actually going to have information about a pending cybersecurity attack that's about to happen that might result in a disaster declaration, as opposed to, somebody got into such and such a system, and now that's going to be a big problem fixing it? I mean, I'm not saying that doesn't. I'm just trying to get some clarity between the threat of a cybersecurity attack versus, guess what, we just had one.
Representative Eastman, through the chair.
I'd be Representative Klayman.
Oh, Klayman, sorry. My apologies. Representative Klayman through the chair. I very much appreciate that question. And in the industry, what we call zero-day attacks, where that time interval from how much intelligence we get beforehand to the time of an actual attack has been shrinking and continues to shrink. So we very much value the intelligence that we get from federal partners and from other industry partners. For example, SolarWinds. The state received the update on SolarWinds literally a couple hours before it started to hit everywhere else, and we were able to take action very quickly. But quite often, yes, anymore, the days of getting advance notice are disappearing, and it's very much minutes or as it's happening.
Follow-up.
So would it be fair to say, at least in terms of the cybersecurity attacks that have to do with critical data, as a practical matter, we're not talking about a disaster declaration because tomorrow we think something's coming. It's going to be more, this just happened, and there's a lot of problems, and now we need help fixing it, and it's going to take time and money.
A representative claimant through the chair. It's going to be a little bit of a mix. As I mentioned with SolarWinds, we did get some advance notice. Certainly with certain other elements, we received word about a week in advance for certain Iranian activities. But it's a mixed bag right now as to how much advance notice we will get, if any.
Any other questions from the committee? Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Yes, through the chair. I'm just wondering, do you have any other thoughts just in general? Does, with respect to cybersecurity, does this go far enough? Does it encompass what we need? Are there any pieces missing, in your opinion? Thank you.
Representative Kaufman, through the chair, again, thank you for that question. And it's a start. There is work that needs to be done, but this is a significant start.
All right. Thank you.
I might just inject a quick follow-up question on Representative Kaufman's question, given your answer, Mr. Brunig. And if there's work that needs to be done beyond the scope of this bill, just on cyber security in general, are there any sort of top-level points you would recommend the legislature further explore or investigate for additional work?
Again, appreciate the question. Yes, I think there should be. I don't want to redirect or miss the focus on this bill. I think it's a start, but I certainly would welcome follow-up discussion and investigation.
We'll go to Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question I have is, do you know of any available federal funds that are specific to cyber attacks in a declared emergency that would warrant adding this, besides notifying the public of a widespread attack, that one of the purposes of the emergency declaration would be to access more funding? Is that something that is currently available in the federal government?
Representative Vance, through the chair, I do know that the state currently does get, as you mentioned, funding through FEMA for emergency response. And recently, CISA announced that they are looking at adding more funding. They have not disclosed how much that is or when that will be made available, but they have announced that that is their intent, is to bolster that. So yes, that will be forthcoming at some point.
And Mr. Brunig, I heard the acronym CISA, I think. Did I hear that right? And if so, what does that acronym stand for?
Yes, thank you. So the acronym, it's a federal organization, and CISA stands, I'm going to look that up, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency is the acronym.
Thank you. Any further questions for Mr. Brunig from the committee? Representative Story.
Hi, thank you, Christ Tompkins. Through the chair, is there a certain level of a disaster, so to speak, that one has to reach in a cybersecurity event to qualify for assistance? Or how does one set that level?
Representative Story, through the chair, there is a framework for determining the levels of types of attack and disasters as exists today with the state in other areas, whether it's fires or pandemic or things like that. It can vary wildly, and there are different levels and criteria for that.
Follow up.
If
it's possible, I would like to see a description of that, if it could come to the committee.
Yes, I'll be happy to provide what we do have currently and the efforts going forward.
Thank you.
Seeing no further questions, we'll move next in invited testimony to Paul Nelson from DMVA. Mr. Nelson, if you can hear us, please put yourself on the record and present your invited testimony.
Yes, thank you, sir. For the record, my name is Paul Nelson. I am the director of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management for the state of Alaska. I was made available for this committee hearing to answer questions. So at this time, I don't have any official testimony prepared, but I look forward to answering any questions that the committee might have.
Thank you. questions from the committee for Mr. Nelson? Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and through the chair. Now, I understand that once a disaster is declared, that the division is a part of that process, or even before that, when the decision of whether or not to declare the disaster is being made. Now, I understand on page 2 of the bill, it talks about not only cybersecurity attacks, but cybersecurity vulnerabilities. And I'm not entirely sure what a cybersecurity vulnerability is. Is that something that your division would be discerning or helping us to understand if something is, in fact, a cybersecurity vulnerability?
Thank you for that question, Representative Eastman, through the chair. That would be something that we would have a part in, but it would be a minor role, as we would follow the lead of OIT to identify vulnerabilities, and we would work in partnership with them as well as any other federal partners or infrastructure partners, whether it's public utility or private sector, to determine what those vulnerabilities are. And we would have a piece of trying to mitigate and then, you know, of course, in the best case scenario, to eliminate identified vulnerabilities in the cybersecurity domain.
Thank you.
Other questions for Mr. Nelson? Representative Kaufman.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, do you have any thoughts on kind of how we stand in Alaska relative to others? Are we just getting started, or are we in good shape? Just relative perspective, please.
Thank you, Representative Kaufman, for that question. Through the chair, my assessment from the perspective of emergency management, from seeing in Homeland Security, from seeing some of our threat postures, while I certainly appreciate all the previous testimony that's been given today, we seem to be okay. But I would echo that we have a lot of work to do on this. I know that the Department of Military Veterans Affairs supports this bill, but I think it was mentioned by Mr. Bruning that we have a lot of work to do going forward, and this is a great start. And it would give us some leverage points to kind of determine the appropriate path as a state, holistically as a state, to move towards a goal of improving our infrastructure. This is a new battlefield. It will continue. There is no indication that this is ever going to stop. Every indication that we get from intelligence is that it is only going to grow and get more advanced. So the better prepared we are to get ahead of it, the better we are off as a state and a nation.
Additional questions? I guess question I'd have for you, Mr. Nelson, given what we know about the cyber attack on the Matsu Borough government, were House Bill 3 to be law, how would your agency, and I suppose this might be a question for Mr. Brunick, so Mr. Brunick, feel free to chime in as well. How would the state of Alaska evaluate the impact of that cyber attack, whether it basically reaches the threshold of warranting a disaster declaration or not?
So, Representative Chris Tompkins, this is Mr. Nelson. I'll go first, but I certainly appreciate Mr. Bruning's comments. What we would do, as we did with those events that occurred, we would stand up the State Emergency Operations Center and start evaluating the response following OIT's lead, because it would be a cybersecurity event. That type of response is actually the common thread. It's really the foundation for any type of response. So whether it be the earthquake or flooding or any other type of response that we deal with. So we would stand up all those functions to make sure that we're supporting wherever the intrusion has happened, and taking the lead as far as finding out what OIT needs. Again, wherever the intrusion actually was, whether it was a critical infrastructure facility or statewide or, focused within, I think a Division of Elections was mentioned, and really looking to try to find out what their immediate needs are. and then moving forward from there. So not having it in the definition of a disaster within Alaska Statute 2623900 kind of makes it a little bit more obscure, whereas when it's in that definition and the language that's in House Bill 3 would help us identify, and we can start improving the state emergency operations plan based on that. And again, that would be part of that ongoing work that I mentioned earlier.
And Mr. Brunick, any comments as to that question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to expand a little bit as well, and Mr. Nelson is absolutely accurate, and I support everything he said. In addition, the National Guard is building, through their own mandate, a cyber capability. And so identifying this as a leverage point for declaring a disaster would then also enable that group to then be brought to bear to support throughout the state from the National Guard that membership and cyber support.
Any other questions for DMVA or Mr. Nelson from the committee? All right, and we'll move to our third invited testifier, Peter House in Wasilla. Mr. House, if you can hear us, please put yourself on the record and present your testimony.
My name is, yes, thank you. Thank you, Chairman. My name is Peter House, and I have written a small testimony here. So for the record, my name is Peter House, and I'm the founder and CEO of DeepTree Incorporated. We're an IT firm that specializes in risk management, and we have a particular emphasis on cybersecurity. My testimony today is in support of House Bill 3, which appends the language regarding cybersecurity tax on state infrastructure to the list of declarable disasters. I just have a couple of short stories and some linking concepts there. I did work as a professional on the Matsubara incident, and I got to see firsthand the scope as both a professional and somebody who lives in the Matsubara. I did see the impact on the lives of the neighbors and citizens in the area. And whether it was in the scope of losing access to essential services or disruptions to business, it was very much functionally equivalent to being impacted by a traditionally defined disaster. As a responder, the level of responsibility was fairly significant. We had citizen lives that were impacted by that lack of supporting digital infrastructure. And we had two significant tasks on hand. We needed to restore services as quickly as possible, but we also needed to ensure that the evidence that was captured and required by law enforcement and insurance was retained as well. And sometimes it felt like those two tasks were at odds with each other when it came to resources and staffing. Because of that depth and because of the depth and breadth of the attack, we needed both specialists and generalists, and we needed a good number of those at that. And the number of people that would fill the daily briefings for the first few months was standing room only. Because of those operational factors and a need to have access to good crucial systems and access to good talent, the borough's declaration of a state of emergency was really essential. We received improved operational agility. We had improved response capabilities. And that extra support that came as a result of that declaration really made a significant impact to how quickly services were restored. Believe it or not, that could have taken longer. We have as a state, I believe, a pretty unique profile. We're sparsely populated, and we're spread out over thousands of miles as well. And because of that, in many cases, digital technology isn't a nice to have, it's a must have. And that puts the digital systems upon which we rely in a place of operational significance. And sometimes the replacements for that equipment are thousands of miles away. So just going down to the warehouse and getting out a new stack of servers or a new set of switches may not be viable. And sometimes so is the specialized expertise that we need. For this data, for the Matsu Bureau, there was a number of specialists that flew in from out of state to augment and enhance the capabilities of the in-state responders that were on site. It's not really well known that the attack on Target in 2013 actually had an initial point of entry through an HVAC vendor. The criminal actors identified a third-party vendor, sent a phishing email, compromised the systems, and then wrote an engineer's laptop onto the network when the engineer went on site. And then the rest of that is history. That's an important story because in a small state like ours, we're really connected, more so than I think other states might feel. And that, in my opinion, when we look at the state of Alaska and the threat exposure that can come from a situation like that, I feel like we do have a mildly higher threat profile given our location and geographic location and some of the things that we do economically relative to other states. We don't have a lot of economic crown jewels, but we have a few, and they're really important to us. So as a private citizen and as a professional, knowing that the state of Alaska has a strong security posture, has an ability to respond to an emergency like this, in my opinion, enhances our overall defensive posture as a state. The stronger you are, I believe the stronger we are as a whole. And that concludes my testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. House, for that testimony. Very, very helpful. Questions from the committee? Going right to left, in literal terms and figurative terms, Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and through the chair. Yes, so you had mentioned the state having a higher risk profile. I think I'm inclined to agree with you on that. And I'm looking at the way the current bill is before us. It speaks to, you know, if there is a credible threat of an attack or, and I want to focus on the or a cybersecurity vulnerability that, you know, has a high probability of occurring in the future. And I'm wondering, just based on your experience, does that, you know, kind of open up the door to, you know, basically a situation where, you know, we will, you know, be eligible for a disaster kind of, you know, for the foreseeable future? Or maybe based on your experience, you would expect that, you know, window would close. If so, you know, when would we no longer be in a situation where, you know, there is a vulnerability that exists that could trigger this disaster?
Thank you. Through the chair to Representative Eastman, typically vulnerabilities like the SolarWinds vulnerability that has been in the news a fair amount have the software developer or whoever is responsible for managing the solution, whether it's software or hardware, will patch the system and eliminate the vulnerability. Very rarely do we, in fact, in my professional experience, I don't think I've seen any non-terminated vulnerabilities. I'm sure there's probably something out there where nobody uses it. But in terms of mainline critical infrastructure vulnerabilities, I don't see a very high probability of a vulnerability and therefore a state of emergency persisting for an interminable amount of time.
Follow up?
Representative Eastman.
And are you talking about a vulnerability that currently exists at that time, or I think the language before us is that it has a high probability of occurring in the future?
Thank you. Through the chair to Representative Eastman, I can't speak specifically to that particular passage. What I can speak to in my professional experience is that it more or less along the lines of a vulnerability being a more technical of an item. So systems vulnerabilities, future vulnerabilities, having something be specifically classified as a vulnerability in my experience as a technical exercise that wouldn't leave a lot of room for interpretation. And I don't think that the legislation as it's written today, although Mr. Nelson or Mr. Bruning may want to chime in, I don't believe that that would leave up a possibility for something to a state of emergency to continue unlimited.
Thank you.
Representative Story.
Thank you. Through the chair, I was wondering, in your experience, if you have seen different municipalities, state agencies taking what they can do to prevent cyber security from cyber attacks from happening. To what extent do you feel municipalities are doing a good job on that? And what, I'm concerned about people not having the basics protections in place to prevent cybersecurity. In your experience, is that happening now, or what are you seeing?
Thank you. Through the chair to Representative Story. We've seen since the Matsu Borough event, which I think was a call to action across jurisdictions and really in public and private undertakings, higher levels of information sharing, higher levels of security. We're seeing an uptick in Security Operations Centers, or SOCs, professional services. MSI's Act, for example, is a institution that does a lot of threat and vulnerability information sharing, and we're seeing a lot of local jurisdictions partaking in that information. So if there's a vulnerability or there's an attack that has taken place, that information is shared with different municipalities. We see a lot more professionals undertaking education and training as well, too, not just in terms of the standard phishing or learning how to identify a virus or something like that, but also the more advanced teachings. Like for personally speaking, or professionally speaking, I have a particular specialization in something called memory forensics, and I'm finding the level of interest and the amount of training for people that want to learn how to do memory forensics, which is a specialized portion of incident response to these kinds of events. I'm just spending a lot more time doing that kind of knowledge sharing. So overall, in terms of people talking and working together across organizations and in terms of professional development, we're seeing a much heightened state of awareness and capabilities.
Thank you.
Other questions for Mr. House? Seeing none, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and pardon the delay there. Mr. House, this is a topic that I don't have a lot of familiarity with, and just trying to understand, when we learn who the perpetrators of these attacks were, what are we learning is the motivation? Is it information that can be sold, personal information? I know that's like when your bank gets in touch with you, it's often the personal information. But what are some of the other reasons?
Thank you. Through the chair to Representative Tarr, the motivations vary. For criminal actors, like you mentioned, they're interested in auctioning off typically on dark web, or frankly, it's black market, just relabeled, but dark web auctions where they'll take that information that they've stolen and put it up on up for bid. There's a growing practice where when a network gets compromised, the network itself goes up to auction, and then criminal actors will bid on whether or not they want to try to pull the data off, or they'll try to ransom the network, or sometimes do both. It tends to vary. On nation-state actors, it varies, I think, a little bit to do with the geopolitics. But in general, they tend to fit into one of those two classifications of either looking to monetize the control of the network that they have in some means, or they're looking to gain some sort of geopolitical influence.
Thank you.
Seeing no further questions, thank you, Mr. House, for that testimony, and we'll bring it back to the sponsor. Any questions for the sponsor or staff on House Bill 3? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did want to ask about the language here that's related to the Commissioner of Administration or Commissioner's designee, and I know we were going to hear from DMVA because Division of Homeland Security is under DMVA, and that's part incident response, and then I was just looking on Department of Admin has Division of Risk Management, and so I just wanted to understand sort of organizationally the thinking in who would make that decision, and then just wondering if we need to be more specific about the commissioner's designee, because some of this language, you know, about a high probability of occurring in the near future, that seems like a pretty powerful decision maker, and do we want to be more specific about the Alaskans who are empowered to make such, you know, important decisions? I guess I just, yeah, wanted to understand that a little better.
For the record, Eric Cordero, staff to Representative Johnson. Through the chair, Representative Tarr, that is an excellent question. Usually departments, each separate department, they determine the plan that they want to submit and work with DMVA. Okay. Ultimately, the DMVA will develop those plans, and they will develop a mitigation and response plan. Mr. Nelson can probably elaborate more on that, but that was the reason why Department of Administration is in the language. They have the centralized information systems office, which we heard from Mr. Bruning. He's the chief information security officer, and so he would be the one that knows everything that is happening, not just in administration, but in the entire state infrastructure. I hope that answered your question. And as for designee, I mean, I that would be up to the committee, I guess, to determine. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Klayman.
So, a question about the lack of definition of critical infrastructure, because I know you said you talked to the military folks and, well, we have a list, but we can't share the list with you, which sometimes sounds a little bit like the Supreme Court's idea that pornography, they can't tell you what it is, but they know it when they see it. And so here I'm just a little concerned about, it doesn't necessarily need to be in the statute, but I'd be interested in having a little bit more of a definition of what constitutes critical infrastructure. It may need to be defined, maybe not, but I just would not like a little bit more clarity on that, and I don't like the idea that, I know the reasons why the National Guard says we can't tell you, but I'm not sure that's a good foundation for us to make a reasoned decision. So you don't need to answer today, but I would like a little more follow-up on that.
Mr. Cordero.
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, in your packet you should have a handout call from the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency. DMVA uses their definition and their guidance on critical infrastructure sector to make those determination. And in the handout, they talk about 16 critical sectors whose assets, systems, and networks, whether physical or virtual, are considered so vital to the U.S. that their incapacitation or destruction would have a debilitating effect on security, national economy security, national public health or safety, or any combination thereof. We looked at statute to see if there was somewhere else a definition of critical infrastructure, and there isn't one, but the duty to make that determination was given to that specific department, not just for this particular issue, but for all other issues.
Follow up. This is, of course, the federal definition as opposed to a state definition.
Correct.
Follow up. So I know there's other sections in statute where we actually make reference to federal authority or federal regulations. Would it make some sense then in the bill to actually have a reference to the federal regulations or the federal statutory authority so that we're not tied to writing a definition that every 2 years we come back because they added something, but by the same token, we would actually know where to look in federal regulations to see, I mean, these all make lots of sense. This sounds like critical infrastructure to me, but it would I think the bill would be stronger if we actually made that reference so that we were essentially lined up with the feds in terms of what is critical infrastructure.
Through the chair, Representative Clayman, that could certainly help to clarify critical infrastructure going into the future if this were adopted.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I'm just wondering, when we talk about cybersecurity, which is referenced, you know, throughout the bill, is there a definition of cybersecurity that that's going to point to, or is that not yet defined?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I will have to use one of my lifelines to see if Mr. Bruning would be able to answer that question.
Mr. Bruning? You heard the question. Can you put yourself on record? Yeah, there we go. Oh, okay. Well, we'll come back to him if and when he's available. Other questions from the committee? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question that kind of ties into this conversation. And I was flipping through one of the articles about the MATSU declaration, and in there that they said by declaring an emergency that they were able to access their insurance. Is there, I guess my first question is, does the state have insurance that covers cyber attacks? And if so, do we need to meet any certain what's the criteria that needs to be met? And that would include, do we have to have the definition of the infrastructure, the critical infrastructure? What's that threshold for insurance that may be readily available to make sure that we get that clarified in statute if that's necessary in order to access any available insurance or federal funding? We want to make sure we get any wording accurate in this process.
Through the chair, Representative Vance, thank you for the question. I do not have the answer, but I'll have that prepared for the next hearing for the committee members.
Thank you.
Additional questions from the committee? Quick question for the sponsor. I believe there was similar, maybe identical legislation last legislature, and my question is if there are any substantive or other differences between previous legislation and this legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, there is not. I believe it's exactly the same. This one, I'm not sure exactly when it got introduced. We did have a scheduled hearing. I don't believe we were scheduled to have a hearing, but then things got cut short and we never actually did do that. So this is a continuation of the same bill from last session.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions from the committee, thank you very much, Representative Johnson, Mr. Cordero, for joining us. And just to put it out on the record, I believe there might be a committee substitute with a title change pending further discussions with the sponsor's office. But just want to advise the committee, but that would just be a technical amendment and nothing more.
Question for the chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Clayman.
Who sponsored the last bill?
I believe it was Representative Johnson, but I'm not entirely sure. Yes, Representative Johnson nods from the audience. we'll email committee members about an amendment deadline and a next hearing, potentially next week, but we'll be in touch with the sponsor's office and confirm that. That takes us to the next item on today's agenda. Oh, I'd be remiss. It's the zero fiscal note bill, House Bill 3. House Bill 32, Representative Rauscher and Mr. Logan on staff, please come forward. Welcome to the committee. And when you're ready, go ahead and present the legislation.
For the record, my name is George Rauscher, District 9 in the State House. And I want to thank Mr. Chairman and the members of this committee for taking the time to hear HB 32. It's an act providing civil immunity to recreational vehicle park owners for certain damages and providing civil immunity from liability related to inherent risks of camping. There are at least about 152 privately owned RV parks and campgrounds across the state of Alaska. House Bill 32 seeks to provide these facilities immunity from civil liability related to inherent risks in the outdoor environment. This is similar to current Alaska statutes for inherent risks for equestrian livestock, skiing, and sports and recreational industries. The bill has a list of natural features, conditions, and activities that may pose a danger or hazard. It also obligates the posting of conspicuous signage and a warning to be included in any written contract with a guest at the campground. The civil liability immunity does not apply in the event of negligence, recklessness, or intentional misconduct, or any failure to post conspicuous signage as warnings of known hazards or conditions, or failure to include the warning in a written contract. The bill recognizes that there are inherent risks in camping that are beyond the control of the operator, and guests should be mindful of outdoor environment, as well as the warnings and signage may increase safety for recreational users, but should increase awareness as well. If it is the will of this committee, my staff, Jesse Logan, can discuss the background and any specifics of the bill. We also have online invited testimony from Laura Sachs, who's the owner and operator of the Eagles Rest RV Park and Cabins in Valdez. Laura is also the chair of the Alaska Campground Owners Association, and she will also be available for questions. Thank you.
Mr. Logan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Jesse Logan, staff to Representative Rauscher. As the representative stated, there's at least 152 privately owned parks and campgrounds in Alaska. And according to the RV Industry Association economic impact studies, which you should have in your packets, in 2019, the RV manufacturing, supply, sales, service, and campground accounted for almost 1,700 direct and indirect jobs, $84 million in wages, and over $242 million in total economic output just for the state of Alaska. We can only assume that COVID-19 probably affected those numbers in 2020, but I don't have the data on that. Generally speaking, Alaska, we have unprecedented access to the wilderness, and it's one of the many reasons that people come here to visit. We have a unique place in the world, and we also have unique dangers. We have bears, we have moose, we have rocks, we have branches, we have things that people can trip on. And that's things that most of us in Alaska take for granted when we're camping or in an RV or in a tent. But in your packet, you'll also find some examples of lawsuits that were enacted on private campgrounds in other states. And for the public and members that don't have that in their packet, actually, a couple of them caught my eye were a bear attack where a claimant was paid $600,000 from a private campground. Failure to maintain a safe condition on the premises, which caused the claimant to fall into the grass when a walkway abruptly ended, that was $150,000 that was paid. Tripping and falling on natural objects, $126,000. You have a couple of pages of those. We included these to illustrate that private campgrounds can and do get sued for injuries sustained for such things like bears attacks, falling tree branches, tripping on rocks or branches. These are natural objects and occur inherently in the wilderness. In these cases, the injuries were real, but the claimants could not assume any of the inherent risk that most of us just assume when we go outside. This bill acknowledges that there is inherent risk in camping and puts the RV parks and campgrounds on the same level as skiing, equestrian sports, livestock, recreational activities, and camping. Just for the reference for the members, there is a Safety Skiing Act of 1994, which is 054510, which assumes the inherent risk of skiing is on not on the operator, but on the person engaging in the activity. The same thing for livestock activity, where the statute says that livestock are unpredictable and inherently dangerous. A person knowingly places themselves in those situations is assuming that risk. It continues on for civil liability for sports and recreational activities. That's 0964 or 65290. So overall, the bill extends the same protections to the RV parks and campgrounds. The RV industry is a large part of our economic impact across the state. These are locally owned businesses from Alaskans, and they operate as part of a multi-billion-dollar Alaska tourism industry, and this bill would help protect them from lawsuit liability from things that are outside of their control. And additionally, the increased signage, as the representative stated, could help increase the safety and awareness of the users. I'm happy if it's the will of the committee to go through sections of the bill or subsections as it would be.
I think this time maybe we can go to invited testimony and then take it from there. Thank you for the bill presentation. The sole invited testifier is Laura Sachs from Eagles Rest RV Park in Valdez. Laura, if you can hear us, please put yourself on record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and State Committee members. For the record, my name is Laura Sachs. I own Eagles Rest RV Park and Cabins in Valdez, and I'm also chair for the Alaska Campground Owners Association. As a park owner, private park owner, and then representing all these small businesses in Alaska, I really want to thank each of you for taking the time to consider House Bill 32. I appreciate being invited to speak. House Bill 32 will help small RV park and campgrounds grow their businesses to full potential. I mean, with being able to have more amenities for our guests by lessening the fear of lawsuits. Some of the examples are an owner may not want to put in fire pits for fear of being, you know, burns, install playground equipment or splash pads for fear of child injuries, or they might not want to put in docks or fishing piers for fear of a drowning, or have more additional hiking trails for fear of bear attacks. And we want to stress that we're not requesting civil liability immunity for acts of negligence, recklessness, or intentional misconduct. That's not what we're asking. We just ask that legislature to grant campgrounds immunity from civil liabilities for injuries and damages resulting from the conditions people expect from camping. We request that legislation provide that that we are immune from civil liability for the inherent risks of camping, similar to current Alaska statutes for inherent risk for equestrian, livestock, skiing, sports, and recreational industries. Those inherent risks include natural conditions, uneven terrain, bodies of water, lack of lighting in the campground, weather, wildlife, and campfires. This bill will help us grow the outdoor experience that our guests are looking for. We live in the most beautiful state, and we're proud of that beauty. I feel as a park owner, my job is to meet and exceed our guests' expectation on camping in the great outdoors. Even though I personally have not had a specific problem occur, it's far better to be proactive on this issue rather than after the fact. We are looking for inherent risk protection, not protection from negligence. And we really feel House Bill 32 will open up more recreational activities for both Alaskans and visitors to our state. Again, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for allowing me to speak, and I'm available for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Sachs, for the testimony. Questions from the committee for Ms. Sachs? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering, the way this is written, it sounds like it would require the signage, and then in section C on page 3, it talks about every written contract between a private campground and a private campground guest. So then I guess the idea is that these individuals, and I guess I'm just trying to think of the circumstance of where you can self-pay at a location and sort of the legal ambiguity that might exist in a circumstance like that, because if this creates a situation where the guest at the time of entry into this, you know, private facility needs to sign off that they've been given this appropriate warning, that would just limit sort of the way people were able to enter those locations. I mean, like I say, I know a lot of times you show up and you do like the self-registration and that kind of thing. So I just wonder if that's been considered in terms of how the liability protection would work. Because if someone sort of shows up on site, self-registers, hurts themselves, and then the next day comes to talk to the RV park owner, it seems that perhaps the liability protection wouldn't exist because it wouldn't have been clearly communicated in the way that it's suggested that there'd be a written contract between every private campground and private campground guest.
Ms.
Is that, sorry, I didn't know if that question was for me or this is Laura.
Yeah, Laura, and I apologize, I wasn't clear with that, but I thought as a business owner, you could help me understand sort of what you thought about the logistics of that scenario.
Well, thank you, Representative. Through the chair, personally for like our park, when people, especially with the COVID this last year, most people are moving towards a self-check-in to lessen exposure, you know, keeping social distancing. So we've seen an increase in people checking in online. So when they check in online, for say at our park, there is a list of conditions, rules and regulations that by them clicking I accept and signing that, they're seeing ours. Each one of us across the state is individual. So everybody has different rules and regulations for their campgrounds and how they check into their parks. So that would be something that, you know, we would need to address, but each one of us individually as a campground owner should have some kind of rules and conditions that people agree to when they sign in to as a guest into our parks. If that answers your question.
If I could follow up.
Yeah, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm just hoping maybe the bill sponsor will think about that a little bit in terms of maybe this online situation, and perhaps Ledge Legal could provide clarity as to whether it's a, you know, needs to be where it says every written contract. If that, to me, suggests a piece of paper that I signed that you take into court if something happens. And I don't know if it needs to be more clearly written to encompass all of the ways that people might be doing this.
We actually have CNN Fisher from Legislative Legal online, and if it'd be all right, Mr. Fisher, if you can hear us and have been following the recent back and forth, would you be able to speak to Representative Tarr's question about a written contract versus a contract that is executed in a digital medium?
Of course, so Mr. Chair. For the record, this is Sam Fisher with Legal Services. And through the chair, Representative Tarr, this bill requires that every written contract, like has been discussed, contain this warning. To the extent that there's a contract entered into online where a writing is produced, I imagine that that would constitute a written contract. And to the extent that this warning is included on the written contract that's executed between the parties online, that would satisfy the requirements of the bill. This bill would not require the warning to be provided if there is no written contract generated as drafted. And just for the sake of clarity, the bill does not provide what the consequences are of not including the warning in a written contract. Thank you.
Follow-up, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What would happen then in a circumstance where you've done this written contract and it asks you, say, how many guests you have, but you don't list all the guests? Is then the responsibility totally on the individual who didn't honestly fill out the information? They say they have two kids because it's less expensive to get the spot, but they have five kids with them or something. You know, if one, it's something like that. I mean, I'm just trying to think of these circumstances of gray area as I'm reading this.
For the record, Stanton Fisher with Legal Services, and through the chair, Representative Tarr, to the extent, as you're suggesting, if there's a contract that's entered into that, you know, once the party to the contract doesn't enter the appropriate number of guests, tort liability, which is what we're considering here, you know, it's a very facts and circumstance dependent area. So without further facts, I believe that it would be likely that the campground would have fulfilled their duty under the bill. Every guest included in the contract received this warning. This was somebody entering into the campground without permission, basically, which, you know, could be considered trespass potentially. So again, without being able to dive into the facts and circumstances, which would drastically impact any tort litigation in this circumstance. A campground would likely be considered to have upheld its duty to provide this warning.
Thank you.
Any additional questions for Ms. Sachs from the committee? Representative Klayman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Sachs, do you carry insurance on your campground facility?
That's a great question. Thank you, Representative. Through the chair, yes, all of us are required to have, general liability insurance through our park, yes. We feel that having this bill in place would maybe lower some of our rates in some instances for some parks. Maybe not all parks, but for some of us it may.
Follow up.
What kind of limits do you carry for your park? Is it million or higher than that?
It's higher than that on some of ours. Most of them, the minimum is the million. And then our park in Valdez is the largest park in Alaska, so ours is a little higher than that.
And follow-up?
Follow-up.
In terms of the premium that you pay each year, does the insurance company take into account your history of claims or your lack of history of claims, as the case may be?
Yes, they do.
Follow-up?
I take it you've been successful in keeping your rate. I mean, do you compare your rate with other providers for these parks, and are you pleased with the rates you're getting, or do you find your rates are unusually high, if you want to share that?
I've been pleased with our rates, there is, through as the chair for the Alaska Campground Owners, I've had other parks, they're constantly shopping around. We're more of an RV park, just to clarify. We're more of an RV park than a campground. We have all the amenities, gravel pads. A lot of our members for the Alaska Campground Owners are in more of the camping. They have the trees, the fire rings, more surrounded by nature. Those are the ones that are paying a little bit higher in the insurance premiums.
Thank you. I have some follow-up questions for the bill sponsor, but not for Ms. Sachs. Thank you.
Other questions for Ms. Sachs from the committee? Representative Char.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just looking at the page 2, line 30 and 31, where the immunity exclusions, and I guess I'd love to hear Laura is our person, and then also possibly from Ledge Legal. But I was just wanting to understand the standards here: gross negligence, recklessness, or intentional misconduct. And in the earlier part there on number 10, there's protections here, negligence committed by another guest. So sort of setting a weaker standard in terms of the expectations of behaviors among the guests of the park. And I'm just wondering here, just sort of thinking, should it be negligence or gross negligence? And just wanting to think about which legal standard would be used. Because just negligence, I think someone could be hurt pretty significantly. And I'm just wondering if that isn't a strong enough legal standard, or if it should be gross negligence.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, thank you. I would like to just, for the legal standpoint of it, I would like to just defer this question to Representative, or I guess the legal services, Mr. Fisher.
And we can do just that. Mr. Fisher in Legislative Legal, if you heard the question, could you put yourself on record and speak to the difference between gross negligence and Representative Tarr's question?
Of course, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Stanton Fisher with Legal Services, through the chair, Representative Tarr. So under subsection B, which starts on line 27 of page 2, it provides that the immunity under A of the bill, which is the list of inherent risks of camping, does not apply if the actor, which would be the private campground owner or officer employee of the campground, if the risk of inherent camping leads to an injury that occurs as a result of gross negligence, recklessness, or intentional misconduct. Gross negligence is something beyond negligence. Generally, it's going to some reckless, willful, wanton misconduct. It's defined once in statute. Courts, when they consider the term, will look at the statutory reference creating the standard and the applicable facts to that specific circumstance. So gross negligence is going to mean something along the lines of reckless, willful, or wanton misconduct. Recklessness, generally, it's a extreme departure from the care that a reasonable person would ordinarily exercise. And then intentional misconduct means just that the person meant to do whatever happened intentionally. So those would be the standards under one that a campground or employee or officer of the campground would lose the protection under A of the bill, which is the list of inherently risky things. And then I can continue on. I'm sorry.
No, I think I didn't phrase it right. So I understood that part, but I was just wanting, when I think of gross negligence, I think of it as being pretty similar to intentional misconduct. I mean, you it wasn't just carelessness. It was, you know, there was intent there. So I was just sort of trying to understand sort of the standards being set by using gross negligence, recklessness, or intentional misconduct, and just wondering, if it doesn't set too high of a standard in terms of the protection, because if people are, as I understand, sort of just negligence to be sort of more like carelessness, that seems like someone could be hurt pretty significantly, and I just want to think through whether there should be a civil liability protection in that circumstance.
Mr. Chairman,
for the record.
Please proceed, Mr. Fisher, and we can go to Mr. Logan after.
For the record, Stan Fisher with Legal Services, and through the chair, Representative Tarr, it might be helpful if I'll start with a brief explanation of negligence. So negligence is generally defined that somebody's negligent. You show that there's a duty of care that the plaintiff owed to the defendant, that there was a breach of this duty, and that the damage was caused by the breach of this duty is generally what you need to show negligence. Negligence, we're generally looking at how would a reasonable person act in similar circumstances? And if the defendant acted outside of how a reasonable person would act, that's when liability can be imposed under negligence. And as you're discussing, gross negligence would go beyond that to mean something not just how would a reasonable person act, but did the defendant do something reckless, willful, an extreme departure from what a reasonable person would do is what it would take generally to impose liability under gross negligence. And the appropriate level of scrutiny to apply in this case, that's a policy call that depends on the will of the legislature in this case.
Okay, thank you. That helps.
Mr. Logan?
Thank you, Representative, through the chair, Representative Tarr. I appreciate this line of questioning, and I want to point out that a similar statute in the Alaska Ski Law, and it actually is Section 054520, where a skier may recover for the negligence of another skier from the skier, but not the operator. So in this case, in a campground, if another camper did something that was negligent, then the liability would fall on that other camper rather than the owner or operator of the utility or service.
Mr. Logan, could you repeat that statutory citation again?
Sir, it's AS 0545020.
0545020. Thank you. Representative Klayman, I think we can just go ahead and open it up for the sponsor and staff as well.
So I'll start with these questions for Mr. Fisher. I would note that on the questions you had with Representative Tarr, I think the probably the operative definition of negligence and gross negligence is contained in the civil pattern jury instructions that define both terms, unless I'm mistaken. But that's not my question. My question is, let's take a couple of specific examples. Under this statute, if you have an RV park, you would have a gross negligence standard for things that might happen in the RV park. But let's look at a ski area like Alyeska. If you're at the ski area and you park in the parking lot, is there going to be a gross negligence standard applied to the parking lot at Alyeska, or is the negligence standard applied to the parking lot, but the ski activities when you're on the lifts and you might ski on a boundaries or other things like that, that's where the gross negligence standard would apply? And if that question doesn't make sense, let me know and I'll clarify.
For the record, Stanley Fisher with Legal Services, and through the chair, Representative Clayman, with respect to ski area liability, my understanding of 0545 is that statute specifically carves out negligence with respect to the ski area operator. So if a ski area operator acts negligently with respect to an inherent risk of skiing, the ski area operator could be held liable. And that would be under the definition under 0545-200.
Follow up. Is parking in the parking lot an inherent risk of skiing?
Representative,
it's not a joke. Is parking in the parking lot an inherent risk of skiing?
Representative Clayman, through the chair, based on the definition of inherent risk of skiing, I do not believe that parking in the parking lot would fall under the definition of inherent risk of skiing.
Follow up. So unless I'm mistaken, what this bill would do, if I go skiing at Alyeska and I do foolish things when I ski on a boundaries, or I let my kid go ski in too much powder and he falls upside down and he asphyxiates himself, the inherent risk of skiing makes it difficult for me to sue Alyeska. But if I go in the parking lot and I slip and fall because the operator has not sanded the parking lot correctly, I could sue that person, that operator, on a slip and fall theory with a negligence standard of liability. But what this bill would do would mean that if I slipped and fall getting out of my RV, I would be applying a gross negligence standard of liability. Am I correct?
Representative Clayman, through the chair, yes, I believe that you're correct.
So, follow-up? Can you explain to me, or perhaps this is a question for the bill sponsor, why should an RV park or a camping facility be treated differently than the parking area of a ski area?
And Representative Clayman, through the chair, I would defer to the sponsor on that as a policy consideration.
Just ask a question for
Mr. Logan, Representative Rauscher.
Through the chair, thank you for the question. That was not considered in the original drafting, but that's a very good point. I would say that there are probably many situations in an RV park that occur during the summer more than the winter. But your point is well taken. Why would that be treated differently? When you're in the ski statute, it's not specifically carved out. This is specifically carved out because it's privately an RV park. So the inherent risk of camping would be included in an RV park under this bill if it was passed this way. Walking in the camping or anywhere in the campground would be included in the inherent risk of camping. And the risk of slipping on a wet surface or a root that sticks out on the side of a path would be considered the same under this legislation.
Brief at ease. Sam Clayman, do you have a follow-up?
More of a comment than a question. I think the crux of this question, which also relates to why I was asking the question from the staff, at least in my perspective, these are insurable risks. And parking lots and RV parks and sidewalks and walkways that are constructed, there are operators that do a great job and take care of their facilities. And those are the folks that actually have few claims, and those are the folks that they find their premiums are staying down. But these are ultimately insurable risks. And there's a lot of RV parks that that have a lot of different conditions, and are we going to get in the business of adding a gross negligence standard? I recognize in the ski area liability, and the distinction between the parking lots and what happens up on the mountain is huge. That's a vast difference because we have very few ski areas. Once people get on the top of the mountain, people will talk, they go off bounds. They do all kinds of stuff that, for all the efforts, are hard to control, and those are incredibly hard to insure against. And the ski industry was pretty successful in 1994 passing a statute that addressed those issues. But I'm real concerned this notion that, I mean, I recognize there are slip and fall cases, and I'm seeing the list of slip and fall cases, and most of the claims are all well within the kind of typical insurance coverage that gets purchased by these operators. That's the reason why we have insurance, is so that they can insure against those risks. And I have real concerns about lowering that standard of liability from a negligence liability to a gross negligence liability, when you've just got so many conditions, that a lot of them which are man-made and a lot of which are man-controlled. I mean, potholes in a RV park parking lot in the darkness are a risk. Should a RV park owner who fails to fill the potholes or fails to light there appropriately, should they be able to claim, well, you can't prove gross negligence? I have real concerns about that. And I really draw that distinction between at Alyeska or at Eagle Crest, I really draw a distinction between what do they need to do in the parking lot and what do they need to do on the top of the hill. Thank you.
Representative Vance.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think, kind of throwing this out there, maybe there needs to be a distinction between that is a man-made construction versus a natural habitat on an RV park, that could provide that distinction that perhaps would make you more comfortable in what the bill is trying to achieve. Is that something that would be a reasonable ask, because of, like, a pothole, obviously, that's constructed, that we would see that the owners of the park would be a general expectation for them to maintain, but as far as the natural habitat, the expectation is personal responsibility in your adventure in that area.
Representative Clayman.
I think it's complicated. I just think your typical RV park, Ms. Sachs, may have one of the largest ones in the state. I would predict it's 5 acres. I could be wrong, but I would predict it might be 5 acres, which would be a pretty big RV park. If it was, the ability to control and monitor the conditions on a 5-acre RV park are just vastly, vastly different than how do you control conditions on a thousands of acre ski area. And I acknowledge that there's, you know, the tree falls down, how do you manage the tree? There's trip issues if you don't clean the tree up, how fast do you clean the tree up? But those are ultimately things that a campground owner particularly has some control over, it, particularly within the boundaries of the land that they manage. And so I just have concerns, because I think these are classically very insurable risks in the list of damage cases that the sponsor has provided. Those look like the kinds of risks that come. I mean, if you ask Fred Meyer, do they have to insure against the risks of slip and falls, and they would answer yes. And part of the risk is sometimes trees fall down if they have trees near their parking lots. I mean, these are normal risks to insure against. And I guess I have a challenge with campgrounds getting treated substantially different than other commercial operators. It's just I would acknowledge that in my legal career, I've been on both sides, both defending slip and falls and being plaintiffs in slip and falls, and they're tough cases to win and usually easier cases to defend, frankly.
I think at this juncture, can hold the legislation unless there are any other burning questions from the committee for the sponsor. Three burning questions. Representative Tarr, Representative Eastman, Representative Story, and then I'd like to hold the bill and see if we can get out a little bit before the hour. But Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to comment that you know, the issue that I brought up, that then Representative Clayman was following on, I mean, that's the point I'd like to work with you on, and you know, very supportive of the concept. And We had worked on a similar provision for farm tours, and so that's why we'd had extensive conversations about the negligence versus gross negligence. And I have that bit of, you know, it's a pretty extensive list, so I really think we do want to be very careful about the legal standard and that's set there. So that's just something I hope to talk with you all about. It sounds like something that a couple people are concerned about. Thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. Now, given the overwhelming number of lawsuits gone bad, I guess you could make a reality TV show about it. Maybe somebody already has. But why are we focused on this particular area of lawsuits and tort reform? Was there a particular event or incident that that brought this to your attention?
Through the chair, Representative, there was a constituent in District 9 that requested this, and we looked into it, and we found that overall the economic impact was so positive that we wanted to make sure that those operations could continue to be beneficial to the tourism industry in Alaska. But these questions are all very fair, and this looks like something we need to work on.
Thank you very much.
And I just add to Representative Eastman's question, if there, I did note the supporting document that, I mean, they're all national examples, and I think there's a little bit of prefatory text that said, well, let me see if I can pull it up quick, but that commented there wasn't anything immediately forthcoming in Alaska or that people were a little reticent about talking about it. But if there were, you know, real and concrete examples that the committee could consider, just to put all of this in context, I think that could be helpful. Representative Story.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Through the chair, I was wondering if this is a common practice in other states in their RV parks, if they provide civil immunity.
Representative, through the chair, several states have enacted this similar legislation, and a lot of the drafting language came from a national organization's public advocacy body. I can provide a list if you like that, sure.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think that exhausts questions for now, and we'll maybe leave it to the sponsor to work with members of the committee to pull on a couple of the threads that were identified in committee questions. And want to note for the record, this is a zero fiscal note bill, and we'll hold the bill and be in touch with the sponsor and members of the committee about next steps. That concludes the second of two items on today's agenda. Many thanks to Sophia and Records, who's working remotely to record the committee's deliberations, and to Grace Irving for facilitating the meeting today, and to Nate with the LIO for managing all of that. And our next meeting is on Thursday, 3 p.m., and we'll be considering two bills, both first hearings, both from committee members, actually, then. And until then, we are adjourned at 4:34 p.m.